yet, so it was okay.
All right.
We're going to have lots of conversation.
Propped up there, ready.
We call this meeting of the House Committee on Veterans Services and Emergency Preparedness for Thursday, February 17th, to order. Thank you, committee members and guests, for being here today. So our first item of business is an informational hearing on the Office of Emergency Management. So I'll open that hearing, and we have three guests here to provide that overview.
Well, thank you, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dave Stecky. I'm the Deputy Director for the Oregon Military Department, and with me today is...
Chair Lively, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Phelps. I am the Director of the Oregon Military Department Office of Emergency Management. It's an absolute honor and privilege to sit here before you and do the work tasked to the Oregon Office of Emergency Management on behalf of the citizens of Oregon. I'm confident that my 15 years of experience in emergency management and response, dating back to my time as an unqualified, unskilled, unrequested volunteer to the September 11th, 2001 mm-hmm. attacks in New York, will do well here in Oregon. While I was in New York, I was involved as a firefighter, wilderness search and rescue, and emergency medical technician, and also helped start the first community emergency response team in New York City to be recognized by FEMA. I went on to move to New Mexico, where I spent 4 years working for the state of New Mexico's Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, running their preparedness programs. And then the last 3 years of my career in New Mexico has been working for the city of Santa Fe as their director of the Office of Emergency Management. It's important for me at this time to thank the OEM staff here in Oregon for their welcome to the state. I need to also thank my wife, Nicole, and daughter, Guinevere, for their patience and support during this transition. They'll be joining me here in Oregon from New Mexico in May. So I look forward to working with this committee and developing partnerships and relationships across all levels of government and all sectors to ensure that the state of Oregon is prepared for, can respond to, recover from, and mitigate against any emergency or disaster, regardless of cause. Thank you.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sean McCormick. I'm a policy advisor for the Oregon Military Department. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to discuss an orientation of the Office of Emergency Management. A specific request was for public-private partnerships. And what we wanted to do is just kind of give you a broad overview of the Office of Emergency Management. We have about 18 slides. We can wander wherever it is that you so desire. And we just kind of give a flavor across the board of what the Office of Emergency Management is doing. And so what I'd like to do on the very first slide, talk about the strategic plan. We certainly had some discussions in the past, and we had a Secretary of State performance audit that shined a light on some processes in the Office of Emergency Management that we wanted to rectify, one of which was the strategic plan. And so we spent a great deal of time ensuring that we met and complied with those requirements that existed. We're very proud of the fact of the work of what we did. One of the processes that we needed to do was strategic plan. We produced it December of this past year. Mm-hmm. It was a broad collaborative effort, both networking and providing, getting some stakeholder involvement as well as our own staff. And so this is really our big picture, both in vision and mission, a lot of which is defined in statute. What I'd like to do is just draw your attention on that middle block on mission, where it talks about preparedness, response, and recovery and mitigation. And Andrew mentioned that right off the bat. Many of the things in which we do in emergency management is going to fall within those four buckets. And so oftentimes, the example where we talked about the task force resiliency a couple of days ago, Chair Lively, a lot of those recommendations fall in that mitigation arena. So we will wander where you want to in terms of response and mitigation. What we tend to like to do, what emergency managers like to do, is look at the mitigation first. If we can figure out ways in which we can fix it prior to that emergency occurring, then we lessen the impact and the severity to the people. It's not as sexy. It is clearly not as quick to respond as when people are in danger. That's easy, and that is the right thing to do for our first responders in our state. From the standpoint of mitigating, it's not it's a little bit more challenging to figure out how to elevate homes. To ensure that we change that culvert from a 2-foot diameter culvert to a 4-foot, so we have less flooding or backup on that street. But that's really where we like to put our emphasis. We just simply don't get enough money, both federally as well as state, to do that. And so that's kind of where we'll go. If you ask questions, we'll try and fit it in one of those four buckets across the emergency management spectrum. So. So I'd like to just provide some brief discussion here about the Office of Emergency Management. The circle's there at the very bottom. The picture actually denotes the Emergency Coordination Center. And so I offer, for those that have never been to the Anderson Readiness Center, we make that invitation open. The Anderson Readiness Center has four 24/7 operations in it. And so it's a very important building from our standpoint in terms of responding to emergencies across this state. With the exception of wherever the governor's standing and wherever you are convening, we believe that's the next most important building in state government. We have the Oregon State Police has one of its two command centers there, the other dispatch centers down in Central Point. We have the one of five ODOT areas operations centers and a very effective one. We have the Oregon Emergency Response System, which I'll talk about later, a 24/7 call-taking center, and then we have the National Guard Joint Operations Center. When our ECC gets activated, that's five out of five 24/7 facilities operated as the Anderson Readiness Center. Those bubbles across the bottom, we typically get into the mitigation recovery standpoint. These are goal areas. We wanted to shine a light on two things, one of which is the state 911 program. The Office of Emergency Management, by statute 403, is responsible for maintaining that network for our PSAPs, our 43 primary service answering points or 911 centers across this state. Very important function. Become critical to us when we're doing a response. There is nothing that a PSAP doesn't know when a response happens. Battle drill number one, for us, we hear a problem, we hear an emergency, we're calling a PSAP. They're going to tell us exactly how many calls or cries for help there are in that particular affected jurisdiction, and that gives us that immediate feedback that we need in order to help support that particular affected jurisdiction. Then the other one is grants, where we like to shine a light on it. We do run grants through that process. We're kind of a sausage maker where it comes in from the feds, and we try and spit it out to the locals. Our structure in terms of declarations, starting with the governor. We've talked this a little bit. The Adjutant General did back on the 3rd of February in terms of the playbook and making certain that we define whose role is what. There was a particular point that we wanted to pull back on. If you look to the far left of that, you see Disaster Cabinet and Economic Recovery Council. So I'd like to defer to Sean McCormick here real quick and discuss that a little bit. I know members of the committee, Representative Evans, in his previous life was a part of that economic. That governor's executive order, and so we want to talk a little bit about what we've done on that particular aspect.
Great.
Chair, I have a member for the committee. Executive Order 0820, which I believe Representative Evans was deeply involved in, created the governor's recovery cabinet as well as a recovery planning cell, and it's really been the foundation for the work that OEM has been doing in the creation of a new executive order. The new EO that we're working on is hoping to broaden the authority of the governor's cabinet as it relates to disasters. It's going to identify the chief operating officer of the state as the head of the governor's disaster cabinet. It's going to provide some authority for the governor to create economic recovery councils that are focused on that are going to be led by the director of regional solutions and are going to be focused on identifying economic needs based on geographic issues in the aftermath of the disaster. OEM leadership, Mr. Stuckey and others, have been working with the past administration, Governor Kitzhaber's team, on the creation of this executive order, and we're going to be engaging with Governor Brown and her staff to move that process forward. So that's where we've been on the executive order.
That's great. Thank you.
Just like to draw your attention to the bottom center of that where it talks dual status commander. As military forces flow in, one of the things that's been somewhat challenging across this nation, not in Oregon, when we're dealing with large-scale events is who's in charge, who runs it. And we know the incident commander is in charge. And for the law enforcement committee members, we're not trying, the military does not take that away. It's either fire or locals or police. But from the standpoint of those Title 10, those active duty forces, those Marines, those Army, Air Force that come in and help support this event, dual status command is something that was established by the Department of Defense, National Guard Bureau, and the governor's council. And basically what that does is through certain training and requirements, it sets up a general officer inside General Hokanson's command, approved by the governor, that says this person is going to be in charge of all those active duty forces that come in. And so in theory, you got the governor, you got the adjutant general one step behind and to the right of the governor. And then behind the tag is that dual status commander that's in charge of both National Guard forces supporting this incident as well as the active duty forces. And they're all in support of whatever the governor's desires and priorities are within that particular response. I would like to offer on the far right, talks about OMD deputy director or me and OEM from the standpoint of responsibilities. For what it's worth, I'm the direct supervisor to Andrew, but certainly the adjutant general gets extremely involved in all actions that occur over in the Office of Emergency Management. Slide. The declaration process. I'd like to draw your attention on bullet number 2 on the left side, where it talks about halfway down, where it talks about red and the certificate of the county or governing body for resources. There's an art to supporting the locals, but also ensuring that the locals are supporting themselves. And so the state government, the Office of Emergency Management, doesn't own a checkbook. We don't own an account that says, okay, you need 5,000 sandbags, here you go. That process doesn't exist. So the art and science behind this with locals is defining what their expended resources are. How tapped out are they? Have they gone to mutual aid support? Do they have existing resources to go from County X to County Y in order to support what that is? Law enforcement, fire does this all the time. Emergency management also has those same mutual aid agreements. And so there is an action where we want to make certain and define in that affected jurisdiction, that county, what exactly it is that they're short. What steps have they gone through? And if not, then we start asking state agencies to support. And that's where we get into that process of the state declaration. I would like to add that previous governor gave the adjutant general authority to do state active duty for up to 30 days. Actually, been around about 2007-ish or so. And what this did was the governor said, General Hokanson, if you need, or adjutant general, you need to activate forces, don't wait for me to say yes. You have authority for up to 30 days. Go out and support the locals. Please help save lives and protect property if possible. However, the key piece that we're very, very focused on is the declaration of the state governor's declaration. We'll talk about some of his authorities later. And then on the federal side, and there's multiple different federal activations, both in at the very top of that reverse pyramid, both in public infrastructure, individual assistance, and then if you're talking fires or fire management assistance grants, that's all managed through the Oregon Department of Forestry when we're dealing with wildland fire. But there's a couple of different avenues that go into FEMA, is all I'm trying to say. 90% of it is through the Office of Emergency Management.
So if I can, since you're on that slide, I just want to understand a little bit. The criticism often heard from the public is the time it takes for any of this to occur. And so could you, and I know there's no such thing as a normal disaster emergency, but can you kind of explain to me the timing it would take in the case of an emergency for these approvals and that? Because that's what we often hear from the public. Well, it takes so long, by the time a lot of other things have happened.
Chair Lively, good question. Members of the committee, from our standpoint, the governor's declaration process can be very, very quick. It can be verbal. Okay. We've had instances where we've made the request, you know, at 2 o'clock, and we got the verbal declaration at 4. We may not have seen the paper for a while, but the fact of the matter is the governor made the declaration in order to implement those resources. In this case, that was an actual example in support of fires and getting some National Guard aviation support out there to support Oregon Department of Forestry in the firefighting. In terms of the federal process, it's bureaucratic. And it depends on the size of the process. And Chair Lively, members of the committee, if it's something on the news, I am confident. I am absolutely confident that if we saw the Cascadia subduction zone unzip, this is going to be a slam dunk.
Yeah,
just get moving. But if we're dealing with your typical flood, mm-hmm. winter flood, we have to go through processes, and I could spend the next hour and a half explaining to you that we have to do an initial damage assessment. We have to prove it. He's proving it with the locals. Then we go from there, and we bring the FEMAites down. We bring Region 10 down, and we have to go through a preliminary damage assessment. Very, very slow.
Yep.
We have to show numbers. We have to show proof. CFR 44 defines exactly what you can do for a presidential deck on public assistance. And that's for public infrastructure, police stations, fire, roads, et cetera. Individual assistance when it's homes, when it's houses, completely ambiguous, and it's more a touchy-feely. How well can you tell this story? And quite frankly, the way we write requests to the president is as if we can try and figure out, we can fully explain, here's what the impacts are to the people of this state. And so, and it is slow. It could take up to 30, 45 days.
That's what I thought.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Next slide, emergency powers. I'd just like to highlight a couple of points. Not all states have our broad governor authorities. Our governor actually has the ability to suspend rules and actually declare on a pre-event. As opposed to some states, very, very broad. Whoever was the author of these did a fantastic job in helping assist in these times of emergencies. I also want to highlight that there's a lot of touch points with the legislature, particularly as it applies to money, and those are highlighted in terms of housing, financial assistance, property and monies for emergency services, all touch points that have to occur by statute with ways and means inside the legislature. A couple of years ago, Representative Boone, I think, led an effort in terms of where the legislature can actually, what defines the legislative body in terms of convening and location. Very, very important, particularly as it applied to the Cascadia. So we didn't need to have that majority in order to do something. Reality is Cascadia, some of y'all might be dead or buried under a rubble. Next slide. Potential hazards to Oregon. This is a smorgasbord of actions. We have a lot of typical low risk, high frequency events: flood, fires, drought, etc. And then, of course, our high risk, which is the earthquake and the subsequent tsunami of the Cascadia subduction zone. A couple other ones that are certainly very, very important are cyber events. We've worked very, very diligently with the DAS CIO office and the state incident response team. We have a state chief information security officer that helps paint that cyber picture, and so a lot of state collaboration and partnership in order to make this work on the hazards. So how does it work? How does emergency management work across the state? Now, on the right side, you see that ladder, and ultimately it's a ladder of assistance. All incidences start local. We have to support the locals. City and state wind up, correction, city and county wind up handling this first, depending upon the size of that incident. The activations, the requirements for resources, it just starts moving up the chain. And so from our standpoint, we look at resource allocation, deployment, mutual aid, and then the urgency or need, affected jurisdictions, people, and property as in this ladder of assistance for emergencies. Talk about the synchronization a little bit, particularly within the military department and OEM. Oftentimes the way we describe this by statute is very clear. The Office of Emergency Management is really that spoke and coordination at the state level. And if you hub that out, you have all these state agencies sitting around that spoke that help support that. And so the ECC right there in the middle where it talks, the Emergency Coordination Center, really becomes that center of gravity for responding and coordinating all actions in support of the state. We have multiple locations. Anderson Readiness Center is our primary, and then we have four backups depending upon the incident, or our COOP sites, our continuity of operation or jump sites. Typically, what we do is we lean on state agencies, and state agencies across that bottom, they'll send a liaison, an LNO, to the ECC. So Andrew will have multiple state agencies sitting in there, and then they feed off to their state agency, wherever that is, for their own AOC. We're dealing with DAS. DAS will have a couple of them. We're dealing with the cyber, goes to state data center and other places. Health, their AOC, their operational center is up in Portland. The National Guard, the jocks right next door. And so all of them kind of feed. The center comes into the ECC. We feed to the LNOs, the liaisons. The liaisons send it out to their agencies in order to figure out how to support and synchronize. But the entire synchronization and coordination effort resides with Andrew and the Office of Emergency Management. I would like to offer that the ECC, even though there are 22 state agencies that are responsible and have to practice in the Oregon Emergency Response System, we tend to open up our ECC a little bit broader. We will allow other associations in. Clearly, Red Cross is going to be a part of any emergency that we want, that we have in this state. They're invited to our ECC anytime the doors open. We also have others in terms of association, the OrWARN, which is the Oregon Wastewater Treatment Facility Associations. They have a big play in it. Volunteers Active in Disaster, they have a play in it. So we've tried to broaden this out in the ECC in terms of who can help participate or want to participate in this. And it's not a closed-door effort. There's clearly sensitive information that occurs in that ECC. People are suffering. We don't open it up to everyone, but anyone that can help is going to be invited and welcome to be a part of that. And these are the state agencies defined in statute. There's 22, but any disaster is going to be tailored the way we need it. If we have something in fire, it's going to be a little bit different than floods. And we'll tailor the state support to the actual need of the emergency. We'll invite everyone, but we don't need everyone to be there. Some just quite frankly will be bored and not be affected by that particular action. Others would be. So here's the Oregon Emergency Response System. This was actually established in 1972. And so it's a 24/7 call-taking center. It's right next to our ECC and OEM. And why is it ECC? Because we say coordination center. We're not an operational center in OEM. We don't operationally control the counties. This is a home rule state. And so we prefer to say we coordinate and support the locals. And then ORS is right next door, and they're 24/7. Any activity that requires a state resource, the locals, the counties, the cities call ORS. We need a hazmat. There's a hazmat response. Local fire chief is calling ORS, and that goes into ORS, and ORS is going to farm that out to Oregon State Fire Marshal's office. Flood action, off to OEM. And so we have a book about that thick of actions and describe the incident, and then the operator just sends it off to the right state agency, oil train incident, whatever. And so we just define that, and it's managed in statute. It's a partnership between us and the Oregon State Police to make certain that ORS works and stays operational. I'd like to shift to planning. So just from a planning standpoint and what happens inside the Office of Emergency Management, we're responsible for the state emergency operations plan. And this plan defines the roles, responsibilities, procedures, everything that occurs within that. So we have a framework, and then we have hazard-specific annexes to support the state. In this particular case, I would like to drop to the very bottom of that. You'll see 36 counties. Statute says every county shall, every city may. Every county must have an emergency manager and must have an EOP. We work very hard with those counties to ensure that they have an EOP and a functioning, up-to-date EOP. We're proud of the fact that by the end of this month, we'll have 9 tribes with EOPs. Last session, we spent one of our legislative concepts was to try and get a grant called Emergency Management Performance Grant eligible for the tribes, because the statutory language only allowed for cities and county jurisdictions. We work really hard to make certain that the tribes had that, and 3 out of the 9 federally recognized tribes, 2 out of the 9, actually are on EMPG grants right now, and then they match at 50-50. And so that allows them to have their own program, and very, very important to us. We'll also spend money if we have that money in the grants to also support the cities. And right now, 95 of the 242 cities have an emergency operations plan. Cascadia Playbook, this discussion on February 3rd with the Adjutant General, many of you are familiar with that. Many of you have seen the executive summary. So certainly can follow up more with that, but right now what we're doing with the most important part of the Cascadia Playbook, besides the update that's going to be due here in July, the Adjutant General has put us on a one-year cycle for this one, so the next one's due in July. We also are asking state agencies, and we are doing a state agency engagement so they can do an ESF plan or their part of supporting the Cascadia, and that's ongoing. That's actually happening. In fact, I think there's one today in terms of what we're happening. And so getting state agency involvement and developing their plans in support of the Cascadia is just as critical as producing the playbook.
Chair Levin, members of the committee, the state recovery plan is a document that we've recently completed a final working draft on. It's an all-hazards recovery plan, and it's based on the FEMA National Disaster Recovery Framework. The document establishes and defines the state recovery organization to include the governor's disaster cabinet that we talked about a little bit earlier, the Economic Recovery Council, and then a new position that we're calling the State Disaster Recovery Coordinator. The plan goes on to define the roles and responsibilities associated with a coordinating, primary, and supporting agency for each of the seven state recovery functions that we've built into the plan. Those recovery functions are community planning and capacity building, and the coordinating agency for that is Department of Land Conservation and Development. Economic recovery, the coordinating agency for that is Business Oregon. Health services, a coordinating agency for that is Oregon Health Authority. Social services, coordinating agency is Department of Human Services. Disaster housing, which is led by Housing and Community Services. Infrastructure systems, this one is slightly different than the other SRFs. Because of the size and scope of infrastructure, there's actually a coordinating team, and that's comprised of Department of Transportation, Public Utility Commission, Department of Energy, and the Department of Administrative Services. And then finally, we have natural and cultural resources, and that's being coordinated by the Department of Environmental Quality. The plan as we've built it is scalable so that it can be used across any level of disaster, but its main role will be in the aftermath of a major disaster, something like a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. We built this plan collaboratively with our ORS agency partners. We started the process in May of 2014. We had our final working draft delivered to us at the end of 2014, December 31st. We shared that document with all of our state partners, local partners, and tribal partners, I believe, the second week of January. And we're continuing process on that, similar to what was described in the EOP. The coordinating agencies are going to be asked to do planning and exercise and tabletops moving forward, but it's kind of a status quo right at the moment as we work on playbook and EOP development.
So kind of to recap in the planning discussion or preparedness bucket, we have basically four different actions that are going. We have a recovery plan that we just got done completing. Our EOP, which is we're updating, we'll have a new update in August. There's a lot of lessons learned that came from Katrina and Sandy. The last update was 2010. It's due. We want to get them done every 5 years. Cascadia planning, and then we also are actively involved with in support of DAS-CIO office on the cyber planning effort. So we will move quickly to a different plan, the oil trains, and that response. There are new hazards and the new events that occur all the time, every day. We didn't know on 11 March of 2011 that we would have a marine debris problem. And so that required a new planning effort on our part and in support and collaboration. So we'll continue to shift as necessary in order to make certain that we can get those hazard-specific plans as finite as possible. So we've talked about emergency support functions, and it's really kind of to roll up what an ESF or support function is, and we have it both at the emergency operations level. Everything on the left, the 18 on the left, are in the EOP, and then the ones on the right are what Mr. McCormick just defined in the recovery plan. And it's basically just putting this into roles and responsibilities for each agency. We went from 15 to 18 this past year because we wanted to shine a light on a couple of different agencies. Before, military and DAS were both ESF 7. And we said, well, you know, that's great. We love DAS and their contracting capability, and it's going to be very, very important that we have their support. But then we also wanted military on a separate ESF. And then the second one that was very important to us was 18, the very bottom. And we wanted to make certain that the public-private partnership or business and industry, that we were working actively to try and create a better, more dynamic program. And we got a slide for that coming up. Just in recapping in the community, it's just a roll up in terms of what we have in this state. What you don't see is the private partnership component. But the very next slide, we had recently added about a year and a half, 2 years ago at this point, a public-private liaison. We never had that person. We never had that that function that existed inside the Office of Emergency Management. We've worked hard to try and develop that relationship with the private sector. A lot of what we did, a lot of it came from the energy sector initially, because they wanted to make certain that they were a part of the process in emergencies. And so we have this one person that helps develop that program. A couple of ongoing successes back in October, we had what was called the 7x24 exchange. We had 154 different private sector organizations, companies show up. It was a fairly large event. It was significant. It was up at the 41st Brigade Armed Forces Reserve Center in Clackamas. It filled the entire building. In terms of trying to engage with them in this collaborative effort of what do they need from us and what do we need from them in order to try and make this work. And we focused in on the critical sectors, power, telco, water, manufacturing. Those are the functions and where we really need that help. We had this discussion on the resiliency in terms of energy, transportation, and there's a lot of different private sector that kind of feeds and helps support that. They typically want to know, what are you doing for us? And where we generally help support them on is we have a program, a visualization map program. I don't have this in displays at this point. Certainly can come back later with it. It's called Raptors. It's basically a tool. It's a map to kind of show here's the affected jurisdiction, here's what's ongoing. And so trying to create that partnership of here's where you can go, here's where you can't, here's the affected jurisdiction, here's where we need help is important. We're not the state of Louisiana that has its own private sector ECC. We would love to have one. We're trying to develop this virtual ECC where we can get them in. We will bring in private sector liaison to help support that function within the ECC. It's not a closed door within our organization. Slide. So, Chair Lively, members of the committee, just kind of recap where we look at it from a holistic standpoint in terms of the whole community across a broad spectrum. We certainly still have a lot of work to do. We're happy that we have Andrew Phelps on board to help continue and sustain and continue and grow some of the programs that have existed in OEM. And so with that, do you have any questions of us?
Committee members have questions? So I have some.
Sure.
So I'd like to understand a little bit more of the statewide, how the statewide 911 centers are linked directly back here, or is there, I understand where they operate in the different regions and how they dispatch, but in the case of a large emergency that covers multiple sections where those 911 centers are, so how are they linked or controlled in the case of that?
The 43 PSAPs in our state are managed and owned locally.
Right.
So each PSAP will have its own governance board with various police and fire. Typical PSAP, and I never really polled this, but they probably have somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 different agencies, 12 to 15 to 20 different agencies that they support their customers. And so from the standpoint of OEM and our responsibilities, we have no operational control over the PSAP. What we do with the PSAP is we help provide that network of support that provides the information calling, the coordination with the telcos, the payment of the equipment that the call taker, if I'm the call taker in Willamette Valley Communications, just a couple of blocks over to the north of us, we help support by statute the money that comes in. We help support that call-taking equipment and paying for that equipment for that call-taker. We have a 75-cent tax for all services or all telephone services. Fortunately, through the efforts of a lot of people, some in this room, we were able to get the prepaid factors thrown in here. And so from our standpoint, we have four buckets of money. This comes in, 60% goes to the locals, so we also disseminate that money straight to the locals. 35% goes into an equipment account to help pay for that network and the CPE. Up to 4% is administrative costs for OEM, and then up to 1% for Department of Revenue to manage that money. I would like to offer a couple of things. It's been our agency position We believe we did a really good job of answering some consolidation questions in the past. It's been our position right now that all actions consolidation is a local decision. Mm-hmm. It is a local decision. They own 75% of that cost. Typically across the board, 75% of a PSAP operation is paid for by the locals. Sure. Only 25% comes from the state. And so we defer to them on how that consolidation discussion occurs. Sure.
And the question, and I appreciate that, understand it better, but the question has more to do, so if we have an event going on in the state and calls coming in at the different centers that may be related to the same event because it has, and I'll go back to whether it's an earthquake or that. So is there an ability amongst those centers in that? So does the center have to pick up the phone to call and find out at the state level what you're coordinating and what you're doing with the state agencies versus is there a direct link? How does that work? Because they're getting calls and things are changing on the ground there. Things are changing here. And I'm just trying to understand amongst those centers, so I understand they're local in that, but what's the communication ability amongst those centers so everybody's keeping up with kind of the changing, whatever the changes are happening as it's going on?
Chair Lively, good question. I don't think I can answer this thoroughly. And this may require some additional information. Each PSAP it has to have a backup plan. So they each have a backup center. So first and foremost, you implied it. If a PSAP goes down, they have to have someone to
sure.
An agency to support them. They tend to work mutually across the board. So that lateral discussion, whether it's a county, if two different counties are affected, there's an expectation that county to county emergency manager, PSAP to PSAP director is coordinating laterally amongst themselves. And from our standpoint, the only other component would be if our ECC is activated, mm-hmm. then we're working phones and yes. direct back to them. Okay. And so that linkage occurs, whether it's us to PSAP or us emergency manager. If the ECC is not activated, it's an ORS function.
Sure.
And they call the Oregon Emergency Response System.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned about the cell phone tax. It's 75 cents a month. I would like to see this body at least take steps to keep from sweeping that, because it's been swept, I think, twice or three mm-hmm. times since I've been in this building.
Eight.
Oh, I mean, just since I've been in the building.
Deb's counting.
Yeah, that was in the old days when they had dial phones.
Yeah. Right?
So, but I would like to see us keep that in place, because it's for emergencies.
Yeah.
It's for emergency services. And emergency services isn't us running out of money.
Mm-hmm. Chair Lively, Representative Esquivel, thank you. Senator Olson has sponsored a bill. I think there may be others co-sponsors on it. Senate Bill 432 that discusses that. There have been three diversions or sweeps, however you want to define that,
yep.
in the past. Some have been vetoed, some have been stopped, but there have been three out of 14 attempts. Eight attempts for a total of $14.5 million. Right now, today, that equipment account, that 35% account that helps pay for the network and also pays for the equipment for the call taker, the interest for that account, and there's anywhere from 10 to 12 million in that account today, is
$13.5 million.
The interest from that account goes into the general fund. Mm. And so from an FCC, from a standpoint of how do we access grants, mm-hmm. we have to demonstrate, we, OEM, has to demonstrate that money is going to the PSAPs, and if it is not, then we are not eligible for federal grants in the 911 community.
Mm-hmm.
We are not eligible because of that interest. Ongoing interest is coming out of that account and going into the general fund account, and there's no deadline or anything behind it. And I think that's what Senate Bill 432 was attempting to rectify.
So we're... Go ahead. Follow up.
Sure.
So we're going to hopefully rectify this whole situation, because if not, I'd like to get together with Representative Evans. I'll burn a priority bill in order to get it taken care of.
I think that'd be great if you guys talk about and check on where all that's at, because that's certainly important.
Sure.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Huffman.
Except for Hood River, we want to take sweep that.
it's kind of Hood River. That's Johnson.
Yeah,
that's
Johnson.
Yes.
I'm good with that. I had a brain room.
Before anybody burns priority bills or something, we might want to talk further about the history of the sweeping and the there's a general attitude of not wanting to go there and do that because hands were slapped over the last several biennia. But at the same time, it's I've been told it's challenging. You can pass as many bills as you want saying, do not sweep, thou shalt not. So.
Thank you. Other questions of our guests while they're here?
Follow up on, thank you, Mr. Chair, on Rep. Huffman's comment. Yeah, I've had it in the past, the experience of getting it almost all the way through and then being told that's not going to happen. And there's some way you can tag the money as a some sort of, I don't know, process that they do, but you can call it this or call it that, and there's some secret language that you have to go through, a secret door to get there. And,
but there's it's a handshake, very,
it's,
too.
It's handshake. That whole idea of doing that is carefully protected, and I think that it's been just, it's not to say we can't change it, or we can't even try, whatever, but it's a challenge to do it because of what you were going to say next. But probably don't want the whole world to hear.
That's right.
Anyway, it's not a new idea. It's happened before. And I think one of the most famous cases was when they did it to the Cultural Trust.
Right. Yeah.
And that was.
And don't forget the salmon plates, too. Yeah.
Salmon that's place. A whole different thing, but somebody's doing that, too.
Well,
somebody's testing that.
That,
yeah. But anyway, I wanted to just thank you guys for what you do. And you just make our job so much easier, and you get the word out for these things. These are important, and I don't think you can say it enough. And your presentation's great. It's, you know, shows how organized you are. At least you look organized anyway. So, but it's really, you know, nobody I think can predict the gravity of what's going to be like when we have one of these big disasters, because we have big disasters when we have a storm or a flood, and it's a huge deal for that locality.
Locality.
But it's only centralized there, and it's a big deal there when cows are floating by or whatever, and they're yours. But I can't even begin to imagine what it's going to be like, and just knowing that you are prepared and getting, you know, continuing to tweak your systems to make them work, it's great. And the more people who know about it, the more we talk about it. I'm starting to hear about it from some very weird places, and which is good because they wouldn't normally be paying attention. And they think they're just discovering it. So that's great, you know. They get interested, and
Good.
I tell people to go to your website. I tell them to read the resilience plan, and that always gets a comment or two.
Yeah, I bet that does.
You carry it with you. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Anything further? Thank you very much, gentlemen, and thank you, Andrew. Welcome to Oregon. We look forward to working with you, too. Thanks a lot.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you.
So I'll close the informational hearing. And members, we had a possible work session listed on our agenda for House Bill 2230. We've moved that to Tuesday of next week. Representative Huffman.
And, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to let the committee know I had made a recommendation for an amendment to include housing and housing's partners on that, and it's proven to be a popular idea. Housing and Community Action, for example, are with Ryan Fisher working on the language so that there's not a fiscal and other challenges. So it's a
You're genius.
It's moving forward, but I have told Representative Nathanson that I didn't want that to slow down the process of 2230 getting through the House and moving forward. So if we need to, you know, for her sake, I'm great with moving that on through, and then we can, once we get the language from Housing and Community Action and any other partners they have that want to weigh in. They love the idea that because they do come in contact with a lot of folks that it could apply to, and they want to do it, but we want to get the language right, so maybe we could work that over there if we need to.
Okay. Thank you for your work on that, though. Anything else to come before the committee?
I'm trusting over there.
Not? We'll adjourn. Thank you.
Hey, look at who's heading that up.